the oldest and most prestigious chair in Iranian studies. He has written 12 books, edited 4, and contributed chapters to many more. He's also the author of over 100 essays, articles, and book reviews in major scholarly and peer-reviewed journals on subjects ranging from, and this is what I love about being a sociologist, you get to do anything. Iranian studies, I am a sociologist as well. Shiism, medieval and modern Islamic intellectual history, comparative literature, world cinema, trans aesthetics, transnational art, philosophy, mysticism, theology, post-colonial theory, and cultural studies. Also, in the context of his commitment to advancing transnational art and independent world cinema, he's the founder of Dreams of a Nation, which is a Palestinian film program dedicated to preserving and safeguarding Palestinian cinema. In addition to being a teacher and a writer, he's also a public speaker and current affair essayist, as well as a staunch anti-war activist. With that, I'm honored and pleased to present to you Professor Hamid Debashi to speak on defending civil liberties and resisting the empire.
Good evening, everybody. I'm very grateful to the Chicago Coalition Against War and Racism, and also the Paul Student Against the War for their very kind and generous invitation for me to come here from New York and share with you some thoughts on the question of defending our civil liberties. The question that I'd like to share with you has to do, obviously, with the context in which we have gathered here, namely our being in the middle of an illegal and immoral war, and yet the specter of yet another war being fast upon us. The election that just passed, one can read it in a number of ways. One can hope that the message that 40% of our eligible voters send to this presidency, that according to some analysts, for the first time, in fact, people were not voting local but voting national, is quite clear. And perhaps the dumping of Mr. Shock and Awe is an indication that, in fact, the message is registered, that we will not stand quiet and silent while our civil liberties are being eroded and in our name and with our tax money, bombs are being dropped on people who look exactly like us in their fears and aspirations and hopes and the desire to lead a decent life. The question that Jolene raised, namely that in this particular occasion we are going to talk about Iran, reminds me of the fact that over the last few years, since September the 11th, two years in a row, a public enemy number one is generated for us. That is, now we probably have to think that it was used to be Mullah Omar. Do you remember something called Mullah Omar and Osama bin Laden that soon after September 11 were enemy number ones that we had to catch, incarcerate, etc., and then everything will be cool. Mullah Omar and Osama bin Laden are now running loose. God knows what has happened to them. Probably they shaved their beards and are having beer in Copenhagen, for all we know. But the consequences of the war against the Afghan people, that now, in fact, the Taliban are back in the streets of Afghanistan, and the condition of civil liberties, education of women, etc., is identical with during the Taliban period, and this puppet regime of Hamid Karzai has done absolutely nothing in terms of preventing criminal atrocities of the Taliban against the the Afghan. Soon after that, enemy number one, we were told, no, we made a mistake. It was not Mullah Omar and Osama bin Laden. It's actually something else called Saddam Hussein. So then this time again, I'm sure here in Chicago, as we had it in New York, this target practice things appeared. Instead of face of Osama bin Laden, we had the face of Saddam Hussein. And now, soon after that, then a war started. 655,000 human beings, please touch your hands, kind of, figures have this tendency of disappearing, 655,000. Okay, one study says 655,000. Another study says, oh no, it's 45,000. So then you have debate, is between 45,000. Then the reality of pain and suffering of a single human being, doesn't matter if it's Iraqi or Afghan or a poor American that has been grabbed by the throat of his or her poverty, a uniform thrown on his back, and sent halfway around the globe to kill and maim people who are exactly like his own condition, his own brothers and sisters, halfway around the world, just simply because they have a flatter nose or a different kind of a color or hair or something to that effect. It is the cruelty of the war. It is the fact that it took something called Vietnam Syndrome. Do you still remember the thing called Vietnam Syndrome? That it took the Reagan administration and the Teflon presidency for us to come out? One should never come out of Vietnam Syndrome. Why should a nation responsible for massacring people come out of a trauma? Oh, sorry, so we did it and we paid for it, and Oliver Stone made a movie for us, so we went and collectively watched it, and now everything cool. Now let's go around the world and yet create another Vietnam. Why? There's a movie called Dead Presidents, which has to do with money, with the bank robbery, because dead president meaning the banknotes. That is an excellent psychoanalytical study of what happens to a nation when it goes halfway around the globe and maims and murders and kills people. You follow? The blood of 650,000 people, innocent or not, we are not to judge, is on our hands, on our conscience, on us. It was our tax money. It was our elected president. It was our elected Congress, right? We live in a democracy, correct? That perpetrated this is, it would be decades, dear friends, generations for us to come to terms with what we have done in Iraq. Now, the fact that we have the fear that yet another war may be upon us, that this administration may heap folly over stupidity, and yet now shift its attention from Iraq and, oh no, it was not really Saddam Hussein, it was Ahmadinejad. Now we have to target Ahmadinejad. For what? For Halliburton? For oil companies? I mean, what? The human dimension, the psychological dimensions of war. We have to, that is the notion of sitting down and thinking about the consequences of how a nation, it is not them, ladies and gentlemen. It is not, that is those who voted in the last presidential election. Oh, they stole the election. Yes, probably Jeb Bush did something or another in Philadelphia, but it is us. It is wrong to make it, oh, it was them. I didn't vote for Bush. We, as a nation, as a people, are collectively responsible for what has happened over the last after a criminal atrocity that happened in New York and Washington, et cetera, a band of terrorists attacking and killing equally innocent people, we have gone around the world and banging on people, Iraq and Afghanistan and so forth. That is, the psychological dimension of being responsible is still with us and will remain with us. When these shell-shocked Americans come back from Iraq, okay, when these American soldiers that have been exposed to all sorts of atrocities, to chemicals, God knows to what, when they come back and live with us, amongst us, then is the time to think about the consequences of the war. Okay? So the question, will Bush administration invade or not invade Iran, should not distract us from generating, accumulating collective memory. It is exceedingly important to generate and sustain collective memory. Here, the principal problem that we face has to do with the way we separate each other. Oh, she is Iranian, or he is Iraqi, or I am from the West Coast, or he from is the East Coast. I begin from my own profession, the profession of being a university professor. The way that the category of the university professor has developed is that you develop a privatized mind. By the time you have tenure, as we call it, you are set for life. Your salary is paid, your home is there, your insurance, your apartment, everything is paid for. So why bother? What's the point? I mean, presidents such as Lee Bollinger, who comes and outright tells us that on Columbia campus, we are not entitled to our First Amendment rights by virtue of the fact that Columbia University is a private institution. I don't know but what legalese gobbledygook he may or may not deprive me of my First Amendment rights other than by consistently practicing it and in public saying that Lee Bollinger is the most nightmarish president that ever happened to Columbia University, by practicing it, by exercising my First Amendment right, and see what happens. That is the privatization of mind, that you only speak in a language highly erudite, very learned, etc., but to a very targeted audience, who are captured audience, who are paid an arm and a leg to come and sit and for you to pontificate, became very evident to me autobiographically. Soon after September the 11th, there was a movie that a friend of mine had made, Kandahar, and I took Kandahar because it was the only evidence that we had other than CNN about where is Afghanistan, what sort of people are, and I took it around the country and I showed it to any audience that was willing to come and look at the movie. After the screening of the movie, I used to have conversations, talk, lecture, etc., with the audience. Two or three talks into this tour of around U.S., I realized that there is something the matter with this rapport, this connection that I have with the audience. And soon it hit me that as a teacher, as a professor, I'm used to, when I talk, people take notes. And I'm not used to people like you staring at me when I talk. This, that is the condition of me, is I talk and all I see is the head of my students because they're just writing things. So this eyeball to eyeball conversation that I say something that I may actually make a fool out of myself and you look at me and say, no, you're making a fool out of yourself, has been systematically, by privatization of intellect, has been eradicated. Now, if you go, here is extremely important article that Lewis Lapham wrote in September 2004 issue of Harper Magazine about the origin of this business called New Conservatism. When did it start? It actually begins soon after the Civil Rights Movement. It is immediately after the Civil Rights Movement that these huge corporations and think tanks, etc., begin to emerge because they realize people like me, who were hired to tell the CIA and tell the FBI and tell the Pentagon and tell the State Department, oh, if you want to know something about them Iranians, I tell you what about these Iranians. That is the assumption that I will come here and I will consider myself, by virtue of the tax that I pay and by virtue of the fact that with the money that I pay from my taxes, bombs are made who are dropped on people who look like more like me, that my tax collector, that I will suddenly sort of begin to identify with people with whom I live. And as a result, the link between safeguarding our civil liberties and resisting the empire. You remember, soon after the war started, a group of anti-war activist Americans wanted to go to Iraq, kind of create a human shield against bombing of Iraqis. My argument is that, in fact, resisting the empire begins right here at home by safeguarding our civil liberties. I was not just saying something that I would be happy to have a street corner. I do speak in the street corner. Sub-freezing temperature in February 15th, 2003. Three generations of American. Never, ever in my life I was prouder to be an immigrant into this land. Three generations of Americans. Sub-freezing temperature unanimously with people around the globe, February 15th, 2003, said no to the war. Okay, it is the generation and creating, generating, and sustaining a collective memory. As anti-war activists, we need to rethink what happened in the '60s. There was a movie I remember a long time ago. There was a memorable, I forget the movie, but I don't forget this line, that the lead character said, oh, you wait until we get to the 90s. The 80s will make 70s look like 60s. We have forgotten how the 60s, what happened in the 60s. The generation of anti-war activism soon yielded into the 30-something generation. You remember that sitcom, the television show? And after that, we became yuppies. And after that, we became accomplices into something that even in the so-called Democratic Party, we have these things called blue dog Democrats. Have you heard of this expression? Blue dog Democrats comes from the yellow dog Democrats. That is those who vote even for a yellow dog, so far as they're Democrat. But now they have created this thing called, this category called blue dog Democrat. Blue dog Democrat means the right wing, the new cons of Democrats, are a bit concerned about the so-called liberal flank of the Democrats, that they say they have been choking us until we are blue in the face. So I wouldn't be too sanguine about this election, that now we have Democratic senators and Democratic congressmen in the House and the Senate. What is important, it is to regenerate a strong anti-war movement that is community-based. Why is it important for it to become community-based? For the following reason. I have brought a copy of my Democracy, Alexis de Tocqueville, Democracy in America. It is an exceedingly important book. An ingenious French aristocrat, Alexis de Tocqueville, spent about a year and a half in the United States in 1831, goes back to France, and in 1834 writes, the first volume appears in 1835, and the second volume in the 1840, writes a book, which to this day, we both have degrees in sociology. Departments of sociology are simply trying to figure out how could this man come up with so much insight about the nature of American democracy. The nature of American democracy in 1830s, ladies and gentlemen, this is long before the Civil War, right? Before the phenomenon of Civil War, in fact, created a nation across ideologies, politics, etc. One of the enduring insights of Tocqueville in Democracy in America is this. He says that in a democracy, citizens become equal, but they become equally weak vis-a-vis the state. And the state, as a result, has a tendency towards totalitarian ideas, whereas individuals become weaker and weaker. Tocqueville then says that the genius of American democracy is the idea of voluntary associations, that voluntary associations act as a buffer zone between individual and the state. What does it mean? This is a voluntary association, right? So if tomorrow morning you hear in the paper that Hamid Dabashi was stripped of his citizenship right and shipped to Guantanamo Bay, right? At least I have a connection. I have a group that stands, comes is kicking and screaming, demonstrations, letter to the senator, etc. The nature of voluntary associations, of course, the rest of the argument in Tocqueville is that it becomes more and more implicated in a capitalist mode of production, and as a result, its political, ideological, democratic aspirations become compromised. The reason that I think this notion of Tocqueville is important is the function of voluntary associations, of community activism, to eradicate the assumption that CNN speaks for the majority. This is the thing that is being generated, okay? Now, the way that it operates is that the White House, right, comes and says, oh, today we, this or that happened in Afghanistan. By virtue of that utterance, the terms of engagement, I mean, we're not talking about the atrocities of Judith Miller. We're not talking about corrupt journalists who are, in fact, implicated. Judith Miller and Ahmad Chalabi in the best circumstances, fooled the New York Times, and New York Times, in terms, fooled an entire nation into believing that Saddam Hussein was sitting over weapons of mass destruction. Saddam Hussein had connection to Al-Qaeda, which was all lies. We're not talking about such blatant examples of deceitful behavior like people like Judith Miller. We're talking about the language with which we talk. For example, soon after September the 11th, in an interview, I said, this notion of Al-Qaeda is a very fishy kind of a thing. Why do I mean? I said, well, it doesn't mean that Al-Qaeda doesn't exist. I'm sure somewhere in Afghanistan, in some cave, Osama bin Laden is presiding over some terrorist organization, Al-Qaeda. However, the way I hear it, what Pentagon is doing is using the idea of Al-Qaeda as an omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent terrorist organization in order to remodulate American military. Why? Because the projection of power of the United States military is much more than the reality of the US military. And I'll give you a very simple example. Iraq was in war with Iran between 1980 and 1988, 8 years of war. Then Saddam Hussein invades Kuwait, and the first Gulf War happens, and General Schwarzkopf bombed every military operation and everything in that Saddam Hussein did to smithereens, correct? The entirety of the Clinton administration, Iraq was being bombed, okay? You remember it. After that, Hans Blix, on behalf of the United Nations, was sent to dismantle the defense mechanism of Iraqi army, right? So by the time U.S. Army invades Iraq in March 21st, 2003, this is the state of Iraq. When was it that President Bush said mission accomplished? Exactly. And look at the state of the more you increase, the more the insurgency increases, right? So-called insurgency. So my argument was the 350,000 is the size of the deployment of U.S. Army in the Persian Gulf area, which has pretty much exhausted what the U.S. Army can do. So much so that North Koreans are waving their nuclear warhead. We have it, if you want it, right here. But there is nothing that Bush administration can do, right? Because in order to redeploy and go back into another theater of operation. So now, I don't have any evidence. I'm an ordinary citizen. In order to prove this point, I'm speculating that what I hear about this Al-Qaeda, this, and now we are in New York. I don't know if you have it in Chicago. This is the yellow, orange now, and then we may go to red, and oh my God, the sales of thing went up. No, the danger is now lower. Go out shopping. Remember, the first thing that President Bush said, people should go and start shopping. This is what I mean by speculative. I mean, we don't have access to data. We don't know what do we do. So as soon as I say that, I'm scandalized throughout New York that he thinks that Al-Qaeda doesn't exist. And as a result, he's anti-American, anti-Israel, pro-terrorist. After a while, it drop a pro, and I become just a terrorist, definition of the terrorist, right? So the point is that we have to come out of our cocoons, whatever our cocoons are. Usually these cocoons are comfortable, and begin the act of community activism that forces you to question and challenge your assumptions, your operations, whatever they are. And as a result, a mode of community activism is generated that creates and sustains memory for itself. You follow? That is, doesn't stop and say, oh, okay, Ahmadinejad is a horrible man. Of course Ahmadinejad is a horrible man. We didn't have to wait to know that Ahmadinejad is a horrible man, and is a dangerous man, and is an idiotic man. But how did that happen? They say, oh, there is an Islamic theocracy there. Yes, it is an Islamic theocracy. But how did that happen? 1979, between 1977 and 1979, a magnificent social revolution happened. An entirely US-backed, corrupt monarchy was challenged and destroyed. Between 1977 and 1979, the Iranian Revolution was a multifaceted, pluralistic, cosmopolitan, beautiful revolution. Nothing wrong with it. It was so popular that, in fact, all the corrupt Arab states and all the corrupt states to the east, of Pakistan, Afghanistan, etc., began to tremble, right? What does the Reagan administration do? Creates two bumper zones around this, the appeal of then Iranian revolution. One bumper zone is Saddam Hussein, 8 years of war between Iran, as Kissinger said, oh, too bad they can't just kill each other off, right? To the west of Islamic Republic, and they created Taliban. Who created Taliban? You don't have to be my age to remember when Ronald Reagan brought the leaders of then, when they were called Mujahideen, to White House, referred to them as, quote, functional equivalent of our founding fathers, end of quote. Okay? They created them. To do what? To a battle, to have two functions. Fight against the Soviets because of during the Soviet occupation and prevent the spread of the Iranian Revolution eastward. Well, they succeeded. They succeeded to give Ayatollah Khomeini an opportunity to corrupt a multifaceted revolution, destroy under the 444 days of the U.S. hostage crisis, when the entire world's attention was directed towards 72 American diplomats. By then, 15 million Iranians were trapped inside an Islamic Republic. All cosmopolitan, progressive left was systematically destroyed, massacred, and the Constitution of an Islamic Republic was created. That's the first smokescreen. Then between 1980 and 1988, the war, do you remember the handshake between Saddam Hussein and Rumsfeld? That's the time that Rumsfeld was giving arms to Saddam Hussein, including arms for chemical attack against the Kurds in Halabja. Okay? And during those eight wars, again, Khomeini uses the same war to eradicate the entirety of the Iranian progressive left, nationalists, socialists. And then after that, soon before he dies, we had the Salman Rushdie camouflage smokescreen, right? Again, the whole world's attention, every liberal heart-bleeding left, American liberal, freedom of expression, yes, of course. But what was happening was, again, under the smokescreen of Salman Rushdie, Khomeini was redrafting the constitution of the Islamic Republic, making it perpetually a theocracy that now we have. Of course, U.S. and its European allies succeeded in degenerating and corrupting a multifaceted revolution into a theocracy, but, as the great Malcolm said, now is the time for the chickens come to back home to roost. The war with Iran had not ended yet, that the same weapon that United States and France and other European allies were giving to Saddam Hussein, Saddam Hussein used them to attack Kuwait and invade Kuwait. And it was soon after the expelling of Soviets from Afghanistan that the first attempt against World Trade Center in 1993, and then Dar es Salaam, and then other American targets were the targets of Osama bin Laden. That is, the two monsters that the United States had created in Afghanistan and in so yes, of course. That is, the thing is, we cannot as activists fall into the trap of, oh, what do you mean we shouldn't invade Iran? Are you for the Islamic Republic? Of course we're not for the Islamic Republic. But between being for Islamic Republic or being for the new cons, there are alternatives, right? I mean, this is what they give you. Do you want this or that? No, I want neither. As human beings, we are. And then the knowledge of history of Iran or history of Iraq or history of Afghanistan or history of United States, they need to be made public. There is tremendous amount of knowledge. Here, the question of public production of knowledge is exceedingly important. What are the places that we produce knowledge? We produce knowledge in universities, useless academic journals nobody can read. We increasingly talk to each other in a language that is shop talk, only we know what we are talking about, right? And then when we stop being useful to the administration, they created these monstrous think tanks that tells them whatever it is that they want to do. And third, public at large is left to Bush, Blair, and Benedict to talk about Islam. Islam is really, really a terrible thing. Yeah, of course, Islam, Judaism, Christianity, Buddhism, I mean, whatever these religions are, there are aspects to both sides of them, right? It is the public domain that has remained vacant for a mode of knowledge that enables ordinary citizens of what hopefully will remain a free and democratic republic help each other to not allow it to mutate into a predatory empire. The nature of this predatory, to the nature of that predatory empire, the 300 million citizens of the United States are accidental. This is what we call globalization. Okay? That is the astronomical obscene wealth that people like Cheney and Rumsfeld and Halliburton and all of them, they have and sustain, it is predicated on a mode of the operation of the capital that is no longer limited to the United States as a nation state. It's not. Look at, all we need is a wind in Florida and in Louisiana for the dirt that is shoved under the carpet to come up. Biloxi, Mississippi, dear friends. Biloxi, Mississippi. Somebody has impromptu, press conference with President Bush, and in a moment off the guard, President Bush said, people in this part of the world should know that America cares. What part of the world? We are in Biloxi, Mississippi. And America, where is America? Is it Washington, D.C.? Is it inside the Beltway? This is what I mean, that they no longer, this is the last thing I say, 32, huh? 30, no, the number 32 and 11 zeros in front of it. No ordinary, decent human being should know how to pronounce. I don't know what that is, 320 trillion, I don't know what it is. 32, 11 zeros in front of it is the military budget of the United States between the year 2000 and the year 2008. Right? That's one figure. The other figure, according to UN, every night. Tonight we go and have dinner and we go to sleep. 870 million people go to sleep hungry, according to UN, every night around the globe. Definition of terrorism, you want to ask me what's the definition of terrorism? Is the discrepancy between these two numbers. Okay? And in that context, Americans and Iraqis and Afghans, oh, we have difference of culture, or Islam is a little bit of that way, but Judaism is different. However, Christianity has a different aspect. Ladies and gentlemen, it is entirely irrelevant. When your belly is hungry, you follow, all of these things, Maslow hierarchy, assume secondary, tertiary significance. Okay? As what I had hoped would happen after the horrors of September 11, for us as Americans, as people living in Chicago, New York, San Francisco, to enter the fold of history, to enter into the fold of humanity, not to sympathize, oh, them Afghans, how horrible, but to empathize, to recognize what it means for a bomb to be dropped on you and innocent lives to be destroyed. We didn't have to wait for 655,000 Iraqis to be killed to understand innocent lives in New York or Washington, D.C. or whatever. We could have empathized. But the monumental ideological machinery, propaganda machinery at work made it them. When President Bush stood on the ashes of World Trade Center and said, those who did this will hear from us. Wow, those who did this were there under the ashes. They couldn't hear anything, right? That was the occasion, and that remains an occasion, for American to enter the fold of world history and empathize, feel themselves as part of that world history, not this manifest destiny nonsense that we are a separate people. No. Of all people, we are the microcosm of the world. Okay? I have no patience for this European holier than thou, or these your Americans, you do after the presidential election of last time. How could 50,000 people be so stupid? You are stupid. What, Blair is superior to Bush? Berlusconi? What are you talking about? They are even a more monstrous imperial thinking in operation in Europe. This war in the Persian Gulf is a proxy war between two competing conceptions of empire. Europeans are not thinking of themselves as post-colonial. Post-colonial? Europe? It's insane. So, entering the fold of history, systematically and consistently defending our civil liberties, torture, ladies and gentlemen, torture. 1976, bicentennial, in Philadelphia, I immigrated to the United States. In my nightmare, I would not have imagined that in United States, forget about Lindy England, forget about who is responsible for Guantanamo Bay, Bagram Air Base, Abu Ghraib, etc. We have distinguished professors of law theorizing the legality of torture. We have prominent human rights theorists like Michael Ignatieff. They are responsible. They are the ones that have to be taken to task, not poor, idiotic, sick Lindy England and what she did or did not do in Abu Ghraib. That it had Alan Dershowitz succeeded in persuading the legalization. Oh, yes, we have to. I recently debated him in New York. I said every time I hear the name of a lawyer, the first thing I do, I reach for my pocket, because we just paid a hefty price for my wife to have the privilege of abandoning her Swedish citizenship for the great honor of becoming a fellow citizen of George W. Bush. The second thing, I cover my nails of, you have to be sterilized. Make sure that it's sterilized in order to inflict, this is quote verbatim, excruciating pain. Theorizing the legality of torture. Eavesdropping, wiretapping of our communications, conversations with at random. Everybody says, well, I'm sure your phone is tapped. So I hope they listen and they take notes. And they go and study it. There's nothing that I say in my phone that I don't say screaming off in the streets. What they have is the stupidity of intelligence, not that they have too much data, they just don't know how to read it. Entering into the fold of history, defending our civil liberties at every single moment, Patriot Act, Homeland Security Act, anything that prevents an eyeball-to-eyeball communication, conversation, solidarity of ordinary citizens. This is the power of which this monstrosity of an empire is afraid. And this recent message, whatever the nature of the messages that the election has sent to the White House, has to be, we have to up the ante. I mean, I have no hope. You're entitled to have hope that this new election may have the consequences. This is fine. I don't. This notion of blue dog Democrats is very, very scary to me. But the only way that you can prevent that I'm sure Karl Rove now, right now, is sitting down and thinking a strategy of how he's going to save the presidency, McCain, whoever is going to run for the presidency. We don't have access to the corridors of power. We don't know what they are thinking. We cannot even think about the parameters. Are they going to invade Iran in order to create an October surprise sometime between April 2008 and November 2008, just before the election? We don't know. And it doesn't really matter. The question is not will they or will they not invade Iran. The question is creating, sustaining a collective public memory that holds itself responsible and, above all, its elected officials responsible. And the press is corrupt, the institutions are corrupt, but so far as we're giving a street corner, we go back to the street corner in which we can talk collectively, nothing, absolutely nothing, least of all this corrupt, illiterate, and irrelevant band of self-promoting opportunists can prevent a democracy. Democracy demands an exact sacrifice. And we will be judged by our children and grandchildren if we stood our ground and defended our democratic rights. Thank you.